This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Support for The Exchange weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. New Hampshire House Speaker Sean Jasper retains his post with the support of his own party. Senator Kelly Ayotte gives her farewell speech from the Senate floor, talking opioids, Gitmo, and Market Basket. Governor-elect Chris Sununu says New England needs more natural gas, and he'll use his bully pulpit to push for projects he thinks are right for New Hampshire. And Fairpoint Communications has a buyer, and the plan to put a hotel on Mount Washington draws interest and opposition. That and more on this installment of the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. We're joined this week by Kathleen Ronan of the Associated Press, Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Good morning, all. Let's begin by plowing through some politics. Sean Jasper keeps his gavel as House Speaker, not a surprise after eking out a win in his caucus last month. You know, but even at the best of times, if you squint, the New Hampshire House can seem a bit like a pirate ship. Does this mean the GOP will be pulling its oars in the same direction, Kathleen?
Some of Jasper's biggest critics from last session say that they're ready to kind of bury the hatchet and get along with him. But I think, you know, it's really going to depend on what he puts as priorities going forward. I mean, if they focus on issues like right to work or business tax cuts, gun bills, then I think everyone's going to be pretty happy. I think it's when they start dealing with issues like Medicaid expansion, which Sean Jasper said is not going to come up this year. They're going to deal with it in 2018. That's when you start to see the party get a little bit divided. So, you know, right now people are saying they're all for unity, but it's unclear to me, you know, Lori Sanborn had a lot of support, and I don't know if that was all, you know, support for her or support against Jasper. And to see kind of what those people do and how they react going forward, I think it will be interesting.
And Jasper seems almost a little bit surprised to be there as Speaker of the House at this point, given that when he won 2 years ago, he did it with the help of Democrats and in some sense, at least in some ways, against the will of his own caucus. So he does seem a little bit kind of surprised and tickled to still be Speaker for another term. Kathleen mentioned Lori Sanborn. Jasper expressed some concern that, you know, maybe the House Republican Alliance, which is a conservative group within the caucus, was going to set up kind of a shadow caucus to kind of keep tabs on him, and that in some way would be counterproductive. He mentioned that this the same sort of thing that Bill O'Brien did in the past. We'll see how it plays out. She did have a lot of support, but, you know, at least in the short term, it seems like they're fairly unified.
Well, Jasper said that he didn't feel like he needed to look over his shoulder for the next 2 years. I mean, we'll see if that comes to pass. And why don't we take a listen to what he said after winning the speakership again.
We've been playing defense for the last 2 years. We're now going to be able to go on offense as a unified caucus. There are a lot of things that we would have liked to have done and things that we would have liked to have changed, and we're going to have more opportunity to be more proactive rather than reactive.
All right, that was Sean Jasper after winning another term as Speaker. And, you know, he talked about being proactive rather than reactive. Short on specifics there, though, Jeff.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. But I think if you read between the lines, he has said it, in other interviews that he's mentioned right to work. He's mentioned what they call constitutional carry, which is a big deal for him. There's also a whole raft of election law changes that are going to be on the agenda. And, you know, each one of those are just definitely moves by the part of especially conservative Republicans to put forward this agenda. And he's right on board with it. And as Kathleen said, you know, he's got his caucus is certainly behind them on almost all of them behind those issues in particular. And also, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if some kind of abortion bill comes up as well.
No, I would agree. And it'll be interesting to see. Obviously, it's going to be a budget year, and that's going to dominate the discussion in Concord. But, you know, sometimes in terms of kind of keeping the peace among a majority, you know, we saw this with Democrats as well. There'll be a you know, an emphasis to some extent on bills that don't cost any money, and a lot of the things you name, you know, won't touch revenues. But it's fair to say that Jasper wasn't the only guy elected this week. You know, Chuck Moritz, unsurprisingly, is back unanimously as Senate president. And Bill Gardner will ride again as Secretary of State. It's his 21st term in that post. And why don't we take a listen to what he had to say after winning?
Yeah, we're pretty proud of our election system, but there's always room for improvement. And so it would be an appropriate time this session to take a look back at that decision.
All right. And that decision he's talking about is same-day registration. And, you know, oftentimes what the Secretary of State qualifies as, you know, you could describe them as gnomic utterances, you know, a statement where there's a little bit of room to move. And so what did you make of what the Secretary of State said, Kathleen?
I think it was a little hard for me to tell what he was getting at there, because I think, you know, his stance is interesting. I think that on the whole, he does like stricter and more and tighter election laws. I've talked to him before. He believes that because we don't have early voting here in New Hampshire, and because we do have a little bit tighter election laws, that's why our turnout is so high. So I think that, you know, he is certainly in favor of a residency requirement, but at the same time, he, you know, makes the point that New Hampshire has same-day voter registration for a reason, and that's because it gets us out of the so-called motor voter law, which would make the state have to allow voter registration at DMVs and at some other public places, and that can get very complicated. So we're one of the states that is allowed out of those regulations because of same-day voter registration. So I think, you know, when he says it would be an appropriate time to look back on why we did that, I don't know if that means and see if we want to change it or and remind you all that we do this for a reason and I would like to keep it in place. Mm. He's a little hard to pin down sometimes on exactly what he wants to do with the voting laws.
I mean, Dave Scanlon, his deputy, you know, said to the Concord Monitor last week that it would cost millions of dollars to comply with motor voter. And, like, you know, we'll see if that, you know.
And actually, that was a big debate, you know, more than 20 years ago now when motor voter came on. And it was Republicans who were very, very much against it because they feared that when you get into a, you know, when you go into a register letter, a DMV or stuff, people say, well, you know, are you eligible for food stamps? Are you eligible for welfare benefits or Medicaid, expanded Medicaid or whatever? And, you know, that was a big issue back in the 90s. And I think that it would probably rear its head again.
He's obviously mentioning this because Governor-elect Sununu has said that he would like to get rid of it, correct, Dean?
Yeah, and I think there's certainly kind of a built-up energy in the Republican caucus to take on some of these issues. And, you know, I think, you know, Democrats are going to fight this. They argue that these, you know, these changes would essentially amount to voter disenfranchisement. So this is going to be a pretty big debate again. As Jeff mentioned, I think there are going to be at least a dozen bills touching on various aspects of election law, you know, what we mean by domicile, whether or not there should be some sort of minimum residency requirement, same-day registration, all these kinds of things. And as you mentioned, Governor-elect Sununu, one of the things he mentioned on the campaign trail was potentially doing away with same-day registration. So I think there's going to be a fight on this, and, you know, debate about whether this is reform and improving the system or amounting to disenfranchisement. And you're going to hear a lot of talk about, you know, GOP will talk about voter fraud. And so it's going to be this is the same debate that's going on around the country. And it sounds like we're going to end up having it here as well. But, you know, we do have a Republican majority in the legislature and a Republican governor. So they may be able to get through some of these changes. In the end, what ends up happening is this stuff all ends up in court. So at some point this will end up back in court, as we've seen in the past.
I mean, it is important to remember that this is part of a whole national effort that I would think almost in every state with
both
Republican
parties.
Majorities it's mostly Republican, you know, pushing this whole idea of trying to limit the access, or people, the critics say, limiting the access of certain voters to vote. And that's been a debate. And it's going to happen at the national level as well.
I mean, Bill Gardner's role in this is interesting. Kathleen is correct in that, you know, I think over time he's probably become a little bit more you know, conservative in terms of wanting more tightly controlled elections. And but, you know, he likes to do it his way at the same time. And it's always interesting to see how persuasive he ends up being with legislators. Sometimes he's quite persuasive, sometimes less persuasive. Sometimes he leans harder on them, other times not.
Yeah, and one thing you have to know, yet everyone knows that he knows his history. He certainly does, and he can tell them exactly how things happened and, you know, maybe it's just those who have shorter memories than he does.
Yes, many people do. Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. We have an email in from Dennis of Barrington saying, do, quote, right-to-work proponents have evidence that this policy actually helps the state economy? How does it end up? How does it help working people to give them less clout? That's from Dennis in Barrington. And, you know, the merits of right to work are something that, you know, can get sort of lost in the political battle over it. But, you know, I'll turn this to you, Jeff. I mean, we don't have a large unionized workforce in New Hampshire, and it, you know, as a reporter covering this, it's sometimes been hard to take either side's arguments, you know, completely seriously. You know, this is something the business review has looked at.
Yeah, it is. And it's interesting because, you know, most of the unions in our state are public employee unions. Almost all the private – there are some larger unions at some bigger companies. But for the most part, it's a non-union workforce in New Hampshire. And it does kind of beg the question, you know, why are we going through this exercise every year? Well, this time we know why we're doing it, because they actually think they can actually pass this thing. You've seen other situations where it's actually gone through the legislature, but the governor vetoes it or that kind of thing. So they have all the ducks are in a row on this. But, you know, I've talked to business economic development people for years about this. And, you know, when they're talking to businesses either moving or expanding here, said right to work is not anywhere on the agenda. There are certain national organizations that grade a state on its economic development, you know, attractiveness, and use right to whether they have right to work or not as a good or a bad thing. But for the most part, when businesses come in, they want to know about infrastructure, they want to know about energy, you know, taxes, that kind of stuff, and obviously the availability of the workforce. And right to work is I don't even think it's low on the agenda. It's not even on the agenda for most businesses.
Well, and politically, it's been interesting as someone who's you know, covered the State House off and on for a long time now. When I first got over there back in the early 2000s, I mean, right to work was kind of a fringe issue even within the Republican caucus. It would often be a young first or second term lawmaker, you know, very earnestly believing that this would do wonders for the economy, or just you know, didn't like forced contributions to unions, and would propose this, and you know, there'd be a spirited debate, and it would get voted down by large margins. And this was not even something that could get a majority when Craig Benson was in the corner office and Republicans had massive majorities. And so the way in which over time this has become more of kind of a mainstream issue within the Republican Party is interesting to observe.
Yeah, it's almost like it's been a relentless that, you know, every year just about there's this bill that comes in and it gets closer and closer and closer. And, you know, there are measures. I mean, I'm completely on the other end of the spectrum. I'm thinking of the Martin Luther King birthday, you know, how many years and years that took in New Hampshire, because people just wouldn't give up. They just had the votes coming. And eventually, you know, opinions were changed.
And just to be clear, right to work, for those who don't know, is a policy that would prohibit unions from collecting what they call agency fees. You know, right to work opponents often call them as dues, but the cost of representation that a union bears if a union has to represent, you know, an individual employee in a dispute or in contract negotiations. And so that's what we're talking about. There's several different flavors of it, but most of them pretty much hew to that.
And we're seeing a handful of the Republicans that have been opposed to right to work are no longer in the legislature. So I think in the past session, I don't think right to work was – I don't know if it ever made it to Hassan's desk ever during her 4 years. But in the Senate in particular, the only Republicans that have been consistently against it would be Sharon Carson and David Booten. And Booten is out of the legislature now. So they – even if Carson were to vote against it, they'd be able to pass that in the Senate with their 13 votes. And I think a handful of House members – I can't think of any off the top of my head who have been consistently against right to work are no longer in office either. So
the one thing that's interesting is that Sean Jasper himself, who, you know, has voted for right to work in the past, but he also last summer wanted the policy removed from the party platform, one of a host of policies that he thought were, you know, perhaps too prescriptive and too narrow, and that basically would do the party no favors to be so specific in its platform. You know, he tried to get right to work removed from the platform, you know, failed in that regard. You know, he meant now maybe at the helm when the state, you know, ends up acting on that. Which
yeah,
is
and it's also, this is also an interesting thing in relation to also what we were talking about previously with the election law. This is also part of a big national effort that's been going on for a very long time of you know, they knocking off one state after another with right to work. And New Hampshire would be a major victory for them, you know, because the Northeast has pretty much been immune to that until this point.
Again, this is the Weekly New Hampshire Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. Tell us what you think. Always, the number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Now, Jeff, we're talking about things that businesses want in a state and that right-to-work rates low. Low energy prices tend to rate relatively high, and that's something that Governor-elect Sununu talked about this week, a speech to the Business and Industry Association's Energy Symposium. You know, I was there. He talked about that he would use the governor's office as he would use a bully pulpit to try to get more project development there. Why don't we take a listen to what he said?
I don't mind putting my politics behind it, if you will, my political capital behind it. If we're going to get a better result for the state of New Hampshire, that's all that matters. That's all that matters. And I think that's the mindset that you in this room, and I hope folks outside of this room, take forward.
All right. That was Chris Sununu speaking yesterday at an event in Manchester held by the Business and Industry Association. He was talking about using his political push to create more energy projects in New Hampshire, and specifically natural gas pipelines, which I thought was an interesting.
Which was very interesting considering what we went through over several years, where two proposals were both, to go through one in particular, but go through southern New Hampshire that was got a lot of opposition all along the border of between New Hampshire and Massachusetts. And, that plan is dead for now. But he did make a point of saying, well, maybe they can come up with another plan, which was raises an interesting question. Is does he know something about that? Is there another plan in the pipeline? No pun intended. But
we've been talking for a long time now on the roundup about the issue of supply, and that the challenge, particularly for natural gas, has been to get it into the state, that there's not the infrastructure to bring it in. But, you know, I mean, the governor can certainly use the bully pulpit to kind of push these projects. But it's as we know, it's very complicated because individual towns get involved, individual property owners. You know, we've seen virtually everything, whether it's a natural gas pipeline, Northern Pass, which he has been supportive of, or even wind projects, et cetera, all defeated.
Yeah, I was just going to say that it's interesting that you mentioned the Northern Pass because he could use some political capital on that, and it would take quite a bit of political capital considering the unpopularity of the Northern Pass proposal, certainly in the North Country. Yeah. But he has said he's in favor of it, and it'll be interesting to see if he does use the bully pulpit for that.
Well, the other thing he said was that he talked about New Hampshire's, 10-year energy plan, and he said he described it as, quote, a joke. And, there's a lot in that plan, but among its major points is that, conservation and efficiency offer the best return on investment and should be prioritized. I mean, Kathleen, at the State House, I mean, are you expecting Sununu's how he orients himself on energy issues to be something we're going to see in, policies and appointments in both?
I think we could, and I think it's different. It marks a break from Hassan, certainly, because particularly on Northern Pass and some of these pipeline issues, she has largely not taken a position one way or the other. She has not chosen to use the bully pulpit on these issues to advocate one side or the other. It's more her position's kind of always been, make sure everybody's involved, make sure we're having conversations, which is a little bit vague. And Sununu will have an opportunity to appoint, I think, a new head of the Department of Environmental Services. He'll be appointing someone to the Site Evaluation Committee. So I think it'll be interesting to see who he chooses for those positions. I asked him if Northern Pass and whether people are supportive of it would be something he'd be asking about when making those appointments. And he said he'll be asking about it, but Northern Pass is not a litmus test for those appointments. But yeah, I think if this is an issue that he's serious about and that he knows the business community is serious about, we're probably going to see him discussing it a lot more, whether or not
As I was saying a moment ago, it's more complicated though than what a governor can actually do. He can certainly advocate hate, you know, and as I mentioned, a lot of these projects have been defeated. Northern Pass is still in the mix, and he's spoken very positively of it. But, you know, every time we've had movement on wind farms and other types of alternative projects, it just gets very bogged down in sort of legal action by property owners, advocacy groups. So it's a difficult problem, but you're right. I think your characterization of Governor Hassan as kind of just sort of not really pushing one way or the other is pretty accurate as well.
So, well, and those with the long memory will remember when Northern Pass was announced, and it came during a campaign season when Governor Lynch was running against John Stephen, and he had this event up in Franklin where he was there, and you know,
500
basically,
jobs,
yeah, 500 jobs, and you know how fantastic it was going to be, and then it was kind of like, well, no, I'm not really for it.
Yeah. Well, that was definitely not using the bully pulpit, but I have to say that, you know. Everything else aside, the words of Chris Sununu, what he said at that BIA event was really exactly what they want the audience wanted to hear. They want to hear that stuff, but as deans are saying, it's the actions that follow. But the words that he's saying, you know, I'm going to push for this. We need this. That's what they wanted to hear.
Well, I mean, there were a lot of manufacturers there yesterday, yeah. and some were saying, you know, high energy costs are causing us to consider expansion elsewhere, or potentially even leaving the state. I mean. Yeah. You know, businesses say those sorts of things at times, Jeff. I mean, do you think this is a legitimate?
I think that it is legitimate when you look at the price of New Hampshire. Electricity in New Hampshire and energy in general in New Hampshire is higher than most other parts of the country, and it hasn't been getting any better really. And you know, if you could talk about the argument of whether we need more power, we need pipelines to bring the energy in, or the argument about conservation, which sounds a little as if the incoming governor is not really.
Well, he was quite clear that I mean, if you are talking about actually dropping rates, you know, I think that if you put in a pipeline, you know, rates would probably drop. But you know, none of these things move fast.
No,
and what Chris Sununu said though is he said that these projects have to be done right. And he said, you know, Kinder Morgan was right to be bounced out of here. But he would welcome them back and other people if they did it what he described
the right
as the
way.
New Hampshire way, coming in with involvement from communities, with stakeholders. But, you know, once you have that,
The same thing's going on with Northern Pass. You have involvement with communities and you have stakeholders. And, you know, it hasn't moved. And, you know, anyone who was around for Seabrook knows how long it takes. And
yeah. I mean, the reality of how these things work is something's proposed and people react. And then you have to go back to the drawing board and people react again. I mean, there's only so much you can do up front.
Because the state doesn't have – the state authority is limited because we have so many communities, the local, you know, local planning boards, zoning, whatever. And we have legal actions that can be taken. So you can't. It's not the governor just can't snap his fingers and we'll have a pipeline. But I think the audience at that event were probably very receptive to what he had to say.
I mean, it was a brisk speech. I mean, he was in and out in like, you know, I don't know, 15 minutes, and you know, made some news and got a good response from the business and industry crowd. Obviously, they want lower rates is at the top of their agenda. Coming up, more on the New Hampshire Weekly News Roundup in just a minute on NHPR. Do stick around. Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. Join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. So Chris Sununu is setting his course in terms of energy policy. The other top Republican in the state, Kelly Abt, meanwhile, is sort of sailing into the horizon. She offered her final floor speech as a senator this week. Why don't we take a listen to what she said?
First and foremost, I want to thank the people of New Hampshire for giving me the extraordinary opportunity to serve them. From Nashua to Newport to the North Country, they have inspired me. The people of our state are hardworking, caring, compassionate people with grit. And they have a fierce sense of independence, which I respect and admire. That spirit has guided me during my time here, and it has been the privilege of a lifetime to serve them.
All right, that was Kelly Abt on the Senate floor this week. She said that the spirit of the people of New Hampshire have guided her. Obviously, her loss to Governor Hassan was very, very narrow, just 1,000 votes or so. And, you know, all the money spent and the fact that Ayotte was seen as a rising star in her party. You know, we still don't really know about what her plans are next. But, you know, if you listen to some of what her Senate colleagues said on the floor, that they certainly hope she returns to public service. You know, Rob Portman of Ohio was pretty explicit about that, as was Lindsey Graham. But, you know, Kathleen, have you heard anything about what Kellyanne plans to do next?
No, I mean, she's been keeping a pretty low profile here around New Hampshire. I don't think she's done any interviews since she lost, hasn't really given any type of indication of what she'll be doing. I think there are, I mean, several options. You know, she could – we've seen a lot of people who've left the Senate go on to, like, boards of some sort, you know, and she could go back to being an attorney. She could have some involvement, you know, in DC nonprofit boards, corporate boards, things like that. I think that they're, you know, she's still, even though she's not a senator, I think she still has a decent amount of clout, specifically when it comes to national security issues. And I think we'll be able to judge based on what she does next if she is hoping to return to elected office. I don't know if Jean Shaheen, I would guess, might not be running again in 2018. There might be an opportunity for – or 2020 for Kelly to try to go back to the Senate. But they've – I mean, she's been keeping a low profile and keeping it close to the vest, probably trying to figure out, you know, exactly what she's hoping to do.
Yeah, that is pretty much the playbook for a lot of former elected leaders. I end up joining a law firm mostly, usually in New Hampshire. But there's another possibility that, you know, I haven't heard, but, you know, that senators are very prized commodities by lobbying firms because they have the ability to go on the floor of the Senate even though they, you know, went, as long as they were a former senator. And that's a very, you know, it's like I said, it's a big deal. But I can't, that would involve her having to move to Washington, which I would kind of doubt.
You could also go sort of an academic route for a little while, as, you know, Jean Shaheen did after after she lost and then, you know, relaunched politically. Yep. But, you know, there's certainly a lot of people.
Yeah, it really depends, as Kathleen was saying, on her sense of where she wants to go in the medium term. And she's still young by political standards, and so there may be opportunities for her to run again. If she were to go to a lobbying firm or a defense contractor or something like that, it may be a little bit more difficult for her to come back. But there will be these opportunities, I think, to run for Senate again in the fairly near term, and there are lots of things she can do to kind of keep one foot in the arena. I mean, I'm sure it was a very sort of difficult moment for her. It was, you know, to lose a 6-year term by, you know, basically 1,000 votes. It's got to be difficult. She was a rising star. She made a name for herself very quickly, particularly in the area of veterans affairs, armed services, et cetera. And so I think it's just, you know, it's for her colleagues, particularly GOP colleagues in the Senate, you know, it's a bit of a surprise and an adjustment, but she may very well be back. She's still got a lot of options, I think, going forward.
I mean, Jean Shaheen said, you know, she did say the same thing when Judd Gregg left, too, is that they managed to disagree without being disagreeable. And I would agree that it's reasonable to expect that Kellyanne would kind of have a right of first refusal on any, you know, coming, you know, open slot, you know, in a big race within the GOP. But, you know, it is a time of transition for the GOP as well as for Senator Ayotte. You know, it was a week ago that State Senator Jeanie Forrester, former gubernatorial candidate, announced she would be seeking the office of chairman post Jennifer Horne, who's not seeking a third term, and they'll be deciding that at a meeting in January, the GOP. And, you know, Chris Sununu was quickly out of the gate to back her. Senator Chuck Morse, Senate President, followed suit. You know, does this mean those sort of skids are fully greased for her, Kathleen?
It looks like it, but I guess I've been a little surprised that a more of a Trump loyalist has not emerged to go against her. And I wouldn't be completely surprised if we saw someone do that. I don't know who it would be. I think that Forrester, you know, is certainly a loyal Republican. I think she eventually, you know, did come out and go with Trump, but she was with Carly Fiorina and pretty strongly with Carly Fiorina, did a lot of work for her. So
she was pretty coy about Trump pretty deep into the process after he was the nominee. I talked to her at several events and it was sort of like, well, you know, I'm here and I'm checking him out. And
right. And so I think that I've just been surprised given how given how important, you know, loyalty seems to be in Trump world, that they've not found someone that they could put in that position who might be a little bit more likely to, you know, do his bidding. So I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not convinced that we have seen all of the people emerge on this.
I would agree. I mean, it's going to be fractious. And there was a trial balloon sort of on social media sort of seeking Matt Maybury, the current vice chair, to maybe give a run for chairman. He's indicated that that's not going to happen.
Yeah. And you know, I have to say that if you go back just a few years, you know, as Kathleen so aptly put it, the Trump world in their previous incarnation was the Tea Party, basically. And they weren't exactly enthralled by the establishment of the Republican Party when they all got behind
Jack Kimball.
When they got behind Jack Kimball and Juliana Bergeron. Was going to be the chair to replace Governor Sununu, and they elected Jack Kimball to be the chair because they just said, we're not listening to what you guys say.
Well, that was a very dramatic. I was at that meeting, and I can recall, Governor Sununu essentially saying, like, you know, we need to have a wide net. We need to cast a wide net. And Speaker Bill O'Brien gave a nominating speech where he was, you know, quoting from some Revolutionary War correspondence. It was like, send me reinforcements. And, you know, the delegates did. They elected Jack Kimball.
So I'm saying it's lining up that way right now. But the Trump people need to come up with a candidate. And so far, it seems like they don't have one.
Well, I mean, it is interesting in that the party, I mean, the party was a mixed result. I mean, the Republicans had a dinner this week, and certainly spirits were high given that they have the corner office for the first time in a dozen years and control of the state house firmly. But, you know, question for the party going forward is, can they raise money to effectively compete with Democrats? And certainly that was not something that Jeanie Forrester showed a great ability to do for herself when she ran for governor. Now, it may be different when you're running, when you're asking money on behalf of the party and not yourself, if she was not likely to win that race.
Yeah. And there's also the ongoing question of whether or not they professionalize the party leadership role and make it a full-time paid position and have, you know, sort of a part of that is obviously fundraising and bringing more money in. That's been viewed historically as one of the kind of disadvantages of the state Republican Party versus the Democratic Party, where it's a paid full-time position.
Well, and, you know, Chris Sununu is not a great fundraiser either. At least he was not in his campaign when you compared him to Colin. And given his family connections and his name, his fundraising totals never seem to be that strong. So I think, we'll see how effective he'll be. I mean, now that he's elected, obviously he should be getting, he should have a little bit more clout, but I was always surprised by his lack of strong fundraising.
Well, it was never clear to me how hard they were trying.
Well, that's also true. That's a great point.
You know, you think with the name and with the connections and being first Republican governor here in a dozen years, and, you know, certainly an affable enough fellow in manner that there might be the potential to raise money. So, you know,
I would think just having the governor before your name makes a big difference, you know, from all kinds of sources that maybe didn't listen to you before.
You're very shrewd, Jeff. So, let's talk about
nothing gets past me.
Let's talk about the Democrats for a minute. And, you know, it's a time of transition there as well. Ray Buckley, a longtime party chairman, continues his push to be Democratic National Committee chairman. He was out in Colorado last weekend at a meeting of state chairs. New Hampshire's incoming federal delegation, Senator Shaheen, Senator Hassan, Senator-elect Hassan, you know, Congressman-elect Shea Porter and Congressman Andy Custer say they're, you know, fully supportive, which I can't say strikes me is a huge surprise. But, I mean, this is going to be decided by 447 people from all across the country. Is there anything you're seeing out there, Dean, to suggest that Ray Buckley is gaining, losing traction? Like, we just don't know until they meet in Atlanta in February.
Yeah, it's hard to tell at this point. And I know, you know, Ray Buckley has essentially kind of ramping up a campaign. He said he's going to start rolling out endorsements in the coming weeks. I think the big issue, there are a couple of issues at the national level that seem to be swirling around this. And, you know, one is should the DNC chair be a full-time position rather than an elected official? Keith Ellison is a member of Congress who's been mentioned a number of times and is pushing pretty hard for the position. But the party just got done with Deborah Wasserman Schultz as a member of Congress, and one of the arguments was that it was not really treated as kind of a full-time grassroots position. So Buckley's approach has been to say, I'm less concerned with being kind of a talking head on cable news and more focused on grassroots. Maybe even you could have a second person who would be sort of the party figurehead part-time. So I think there's sort of a debate about the kind of person who runs – who takes over the party. I think it's still in flux. My guess is there'll probably be some other people jumping in as well.
One thing that may help Raymond Buckley is that, you know, we're coming after this election, which is obviously a big disappointment for Democrats nationally. There is sort of a vacuum in terms of – it's not like – had Hillary Clinton been president, she would be like, this is the chairman, and that's how it's going to be. That's not happening. And some of the people who are in positions of sway within the Democratic Party, kind of ideologically and sort of, spiritually at the moment, you can take Bernie Sanders, you can take Elizabeth Warren. These aren't people with deep, deep roots right. in the sort of nuts and bolts aspect of the
right.
party
and
that Ray Buckley
right.
has.
And that's the concern of Democrats because they lost, a bunch of seats in state legislatures, governorships. Republicans have a big advantage. That affects redistricting at the census years. So, Buckley's argument has been that the party needs to focus on the grassroots on a 50-state, in some sense, almost like Howard Dean's 50-state strategy, rather than have sort of a highly visible figure. Head member of Congress running the party. Right. And Allison has said that he thinks he can do it, but that's the big question.
But I did see the other day that Congressman Allison did say he would resign his seat.
He even mentioned
right.
stepping
won the election right. to that. So I think he's even saying that this needs to be a full-time position. And it's interesting to see that this is happening on a national level where the idea of the chairman of the Democratic Party is in flux as we just talked about the Republican Party in New Hampshire is in flux. Although, if Ray Buckley is elected chair of the DNC, then the Democrats would be in flux as well in New Hampshire.
Yes, indeed. And so, we're going to skip politics in a minute. We'll go to some business stories that are interesting this week. It is a time when it will be interesting to see what happens with the Democrats. I mean, they tend to have a more orderly kind of line of succession and less public and fractious, battles, than Republicans do. But, we'll see. If Ray Buckley shouldn't get elected chairman, there's no indication that he won't be right
That's
back,
right.
Sort of becoming almost like the Bill Gardner of the New Hampshire Democratic Party.
He's becoming it, yes.
Between deputy and chair, it's 18 years, something like that.
Time.
All right. Let's ditch politics for a moment and turn to business. One big business story this week was the Illinois company Communications Holding reaching a deal to buying Fairpoint Communications, $1.5 billion. If approved, the deal would create the ninth largest fiber optic company in the country. Jeff, I'm going to turn to you. What does this deal mean? Obviously, Fairpoint's had a pretty checkered history in the region.
Well, right now what we do know is that it seems like it's going to be relatively easy for this to go through because Fairpoint, it became apparent almost from the day they bought the landlines from Verizon, was biting off more than they could chew. Ended up filing for bankruptcy just shortly after they bought the landlines in New England, in northern New England, which is Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. They just gobbled up this huge business. And it was a relatively small company, and it was just way too much for it. And it's interesting to note also that they paid $2.7 billion for those three state landlines, and now the whole company of Fairpoint is going for $1.5 billion.
And that's after being in and out of bankruptcy. There's been a strike.
Yes, it's been they've had a lot. They've had labor issues. They've had service issues. Questions. Certainly in Maine in particular, their feet have really been held to the fire on service issues and on just bringing out broadband. It's interesting to see this because this is another out-of-state company that's buying these landlines, and it's not it's like buying the horse and buggy dealership back in the day when cars were coming around. It's not It's not a growth industry, and that's why this new company that's coming in, Consolidated Communications, is really strong in fiber optics, which means broadband, all that online stuff.
Does that mean they're going to be laying this sorts of stuff up here, or what do we know?
We don't really know that yet, but it does seem that they have done that in other places, and they're very strong on that. They provide TV services and all that kind of stuff, and it's without a doubt. I think from a customer's point of view, it's probably going to be at best an improvement. At worst, nothing. It won't change. It'll be the same kind of quality.
I mean, looking back from a regulatory point of view, was the initial approval of this something that the PUC and others involved in this should have been more concerned?
One fair point. Yes, yeah. That was a lot of what the critics were saying at the time, that they kind of just did not pay as much attention to the idea of this small company buying this what to them was a massive, making a massive investment in these three states. And Verizon at the time, they were laughing all the way to the bank, making $2.7 billion on that deal. And there were other situations in other parts of the country where smaller companies were buying these landline, old landlines from companies like Verizon, and they also have had serious issues because they're just buying a business whose model is just not 21st century. I mean, Fairpoint's been trying very hard to update it, to bring more broadband to various service areas, but it's been a very big investment.
Hmm. All right. Well, coming up in a minute, we'll have more business stories on this week's Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. Join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. And we'll move from, communications holdings, a fiber company to the resolutely non-fiber Cog Railway and the hotel plan for Mount Washington. This is a novel proposal that seems to be getting a lot of attention, pro and con, isn't it, Dean?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and, there's a big debate over the extent to which you should, Mount Washington to some extent is already commercialized, but, do you commercialize it more? This is a small piece of private property. There was an initial informational session held at the planning board, and there's not even conceptual plans or pictures yet. So it's really just kind of in the discussion phase, but you're already see petitions online. Something like 6,000 people have signed a petition saying they're against it, and then about 500 have said they're for it for employment and business reasons. This is going to be one of those things that's going to probably be debated pretty extensively once we start to see how it's developing. My sense is it's a pretty small hotel, like 35 rooms or 30 rooms, something like that.
Well, the interesting thing, I guess, is that the Appalachian Mountain Club also wanted to build a new hut, and they just dropped their plans to do that. It wouldn't have been that much farther away from where the Cog Railway Hotel would be.
All right, more on this in a minute on New Hampshire's Weekly News Roundup on NHPR. Stick around. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers, joined this week by Jeff Feingold, New Hampshire Business Review, Kathleen Ronayne, Associated Press, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Right now we're talking about the Cog Railway Hotel that's been proposed to be 2 miles up along the rail line. There's a 99-foot-wide strip of land that's owned by the company. The hotel would be there. They're talking about potentially – there's no blueprints, but maybe straddling the rail line. 110,000 people apparently rode the Cog Railway this year. Tell us what you think. There used to be hotels, up in many high mountain areas, including on Mount Washington.
Yeah, there have been, and it's a great vacation destination for many people. I don't know if I'd want to be going there in December or anything, but
well, and it's interesting the argument over both the hotel and then the hut that you mentioned that they were going to build, which was going to be much bigger. I think like 60 rooms or 50 rooms, a pretty big hut, pretty close to the road, expanded parking. Sort of New Hampshireites arguing that this is really kind of a play for wealthier tourists who will come in and are willing to spend $150 or $200 a night for a room, and it's the same sort of thing as this sort of competition between people who are here locally who want to keep the area as natural as possible, and then people who want to sort of balance that with economic development. And this is an age-old debate.
Well, yeah, it is. Oh, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I think there were also plans. I don't know if they're going forward, but someone from the Coos County Planning Board said there were plans for a hotel at the base of the auto road as well. So it's, yes. You know, that's – then. Do you really need three hotels there? I think is something that people are going to be arguing over. And I think that the hikers in particular are probably going to prove to have a pretty strong voice on this. I mean, if you hike to the top of Mount Washington already, you've got parking lots kind of dominating your entire view. And I think we're going to see them continuing to fight any proposal that might, you know, mar what they would consider be marring the landscape.
But you have to remember, against this whole – the backdrop of this is an area, Coos County in particular, the whole North Country is in a really, really serious economic straits. And I think there's a core of people up in that area that respond positively to any kind of suggestion that we can maybe get some jobs and some economic development there. So that's something else that you have to bear in mind as this process goes through.
Well, and certainly the state's role in this. I mean, we obviously have the potential of the state guarantee on the Balsams expansion, which will be interesting to see where we end up going there, and also interesting to see, you know, how Governor-elect Sununu navigates that, given his – I mean, I guess he officially will be stepping down from his role as CEO of Waterville Valley in a couple of weeks. But
the family still has that interest, being a very large interest in Waterville Valley, which is a big player up there. So,
well, as the North Country struggles find ways to create more economic development, there was a list put out this week on the best and worst jobs in the country. And, you know, I have to say that, the worst job is a newspaper reporter. The second worst job is the logger. And the third worst is a broadcaster. And, you know, we don't have a logger here. I guess we can pretend that Dean is our logger. I guess I can feel good coming in third worst. But data scientist is the best, by the way. And you know, Jeff, you know, obviously these lists, you know, make of them what you will. But, I mean, you've obviously been looking at jobs in New Hampshire, and what are the strongest jobs in New Hampshire right now? And it doesn't need to be scientific, but
I think really seriously in many cases that, you know, the biggest growth areas are healthcare for a large number of reasons, mostly that we're getting older and we need more people taking care of us. And also there's quite a few tech jobs opening. And actually, there was a meeting just a couple of days ago where the state is in putting together this tech sector partnership, looking at employment in that industry. And apparently, there are 3,000 openings in tech related fields, not just in tech companies, but just tech related. Like if you do data analytics for a hospital or whatever, so there's 3,000 openings right now in New Hampshire for that kind. So those are probably good jobs, but not everybody has the skills to take those jobs.
And in
so
terms
really
of the implications of having so many jobs open, I mean, is that going to cause businesses to get out of town?
That is the big fear, is that if you can't find people to take the jobs you're offering, what's the benefit of being in New Hampshire? I mean, if you don't have people who can take the jobs. And these are pretty good jobs too. And it does raise a certain question, and that's why for at least the last year, if not longer, people have been talking about how it's not attracting businesses that we need to do. We need to attract people who work, workers, younger people to come to the state, because as we get older, it becomes the workforce just diminishes because people just can't work at a certain point.
If you look at that list of worst jobs, the unifying factor there is really digital technology.
Yes.
I mean, it's killing print newspapers. It's making the demand for paper drop, which is affecting the logging industry. Yes. Although, you know, logging is also inherently dangerous in many respects just because of the kinds of equipment you're working with. You can also throw in kind of the sort of election we just went through and kind of the views of the media and the sort of controversial environment surrounding news in general. But technology is really the unifying factor. And there's such an emphasis now on data and analytics compared to just, you know, 5 years ago.
Yeah, and I also have to say this in terms of the newspaper industry, that's also one of the stresses on newspaper reporters is that there aren't that many jobs available as there used to be. Sorry, Kathleen.
Okay.
But no, it doesn't have the kind of future that it had when this old man
when
got into the
young
business,
yes,
when I was
know.
Just a wee lad.
Okay. Well, you know, and the collision of sort of you know, stresses and strains in New Hampshire's workforce and, you know, an area that has been a place that employs a lot of people in New Hampshire, which is education, is being felt at Colby Sawyer College, isn't it, Dean? There's some grim news out of there.
Yeah, they suffered, I think it's a $2.6 million loss. The issue for them has been enrollment. This is the small liberal arts college up in New London. It was originally, I think, a women's college, and then it went co-ed some number of years ago. The enrollment had been up to about 1,500. It's now dropped to about 1,100. There's just generally, in general, fewer students go. There's just fewer kids to go on to college now. I think there was it peaked. The boomer generation sending their kids to college peaked a little while back, and now there are just fewer people in the pipeline. So there's more competition. There are fewer students to enroll. Tuition has dropped. Colby Sawyer has a new president who's come in and assessed the situation. And so they announced, I think they're laying off something like 7 faculty and 11 staff and then reducing hours. But, you know, you see this around the country. There's a very stiff competition for students. Some schools are doing quite well. Others are contracting. It's a very competitive environment. And in announcing the sort of belt tightening and layoffs, the Colby Sawyer president mentioned that it's a very competitive environment right now for students.
Yeah, and also there's also something else about this, because it's not just Colby Sawyer and his other colleges in New Hampshire that have had these kind of problems. And something interesting to note is that colleges do very well when there's more concerns about the economy, because people don't. They just feel like they need to get more credentials. They need to get more education to get other jobs. But I think because we have a pretty healthy economy right now, it's not being very helpful to colleges.
You see that at grad schools too. Yes. Enrollments in graduate degrees goes up when their economy is slipping.
And same with community colleges as well. And so it's all across the board right now.
I mean, you live in New London, Jeff.
I did have a conflict of interest. I go to Colby Sawyer every day to go to the gym. So,
but I mean, is it tangible in the community that you can sort of feel that the college might be in a tough spot?
Well, down 400 students, that can have an economic impact.
Yeah, that's one thing. And also, the thing about Colby Sawyer is that I've been living in New London since '83, and I think it's had ups and downs many times in those years, and they've had actually they were in much more serious financial difficulties several years back, and bounced back, and now they're basically back into another economic lull, but it is one of the major employers in New London by far, and it's like the presence of the college. You could see the college right there, but there's not much.
But I think the concern is they're down 400 students. Those kids are going into town and buying supplies and foods, et cetera. But I think the president said that they've done some studying, and the belief is that they can stabilize the enrollment at around 1,100.
Yeah, and they've also made a lot of big attempts to bring international students in. That's one of the things that's been helping them a lot.
And so as Colby Sawyer struggles, there's some big news out of Dartmouth. The medical school and the Dartmouth Hitchcock, the corporation that CEO, Jim Weinstein is going to be, stepping down. I mean, how significant is that, Jeff? I mean, obviously, Dartmouth Hitchcock's been in the news a lot for, financial turmoil. And, he's a big name in medicine.
Yes.
He's going to stick around in some capacity. But is this significant?
I think it's the timing is significant, considering they've been having all these problems. But apparently he notified the Board of Trustees quite a while ago that he'd be stepping down. So it's not, on first blush, you say, oh, what, they tell him you're leaving? But apparently he's had these plans to leave. But it still does show that the Dartmouth Hitchcock, which is the major employer in New Hampshire, and as a major, just huge presence in northern New England as the premier healthcare provider, has had difficulties, and it's not unusual for in this environment for hospitals in particular having trouble, but because Dartmouth Hitchcock is such a big player, the troubles are much more noticeable and much more, the numbers are more.
I mean, a lot of sort of, kind of like intellectual prestige through the terms of health reform, in terms of, continuity of care and all of that. And, you know, it's interesting to see as we move, you know, to a new regime in Washington, whether a lot of the thinking around that is just...
It really does raise some very strong questions about what's going to happen with the Affordable Care Act and, you know, are they going to repeal it and what would that mean to the hospitals? Hospitals, in a lot of ways, have been doing a little bit better in New Hampshire, particularly with the expanded Medicaid. They're getting money that they didn't get before. You know, many times that was uncompensated care, people just coming into the emergency room. So that can change. That would make things a little even more difficult for a place like Dartmouth if that was to actually happen.
All right. We're almost at the end of the show. I'm going to ask you now what – I know we're all focusing on, you know, the year end and holidays and a modicum of relaxation. But, you know, before we get there, what are you going to be focusing on, Jeff?
Well, for the most part, this is the time of year where we will look at the economy in New Hampshire, what's been going on this year and what's going to be going on next year. So we're working on that package for our next issue, actually, and talking about – and actually from preliminary interviews, it looks like things are really going pretty well economically in New Hampshire for the first time in a long time. People seem very optimistic and upbeat about what's going on. These are, you know, business people and economists as well. So, you know – It'll be interesting going forward to see what happens economically in the next year.
Kathleen, what about you?
I think I'll be following Governor-elect Sununu and his transition. We didn't really see any news on that at all this week in terms of people he's hiring or bringing in. So keeping an eye as he starts to build his team.
I'm going to be looking at that as well. Dean, what about you?
Yeah, it's all about transitions. A local transition here with a new governor and the national transition for a new president. I have to shift my analytic framework from campaigns and elections to policy making and bureaucracy.
It can be like turning a battleship.
That's right.
Thank you.
I got a month.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. Have a good weekend, everybody.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.